You're listening to Front Page Sunday. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. It's time for our monthly conversation with Murray State President Dr. Randy Dunn. Today, we'll break down Murray State's latest enrollment numbers. Dr. Dunn, you've got a meeting with the Kentucky Council on Postsecondary Education to discuss those numbers coming up, right?
That's right. We've had some good news, Chad, as we look at the official enrollment for 2012-13. And in addition to a number of other things I'll be talking about in a report to the council, as you've referenced, we came in at 10,832. I was hoping for 11,000, but knew we'd probably end up in this ballpark and did around 2% growth. But as we've broken down the numbers and tried to disaggregate those figures to know what's going on where, I really am heartened by a couple of things that we've seen for this year. I think we've got a couple of challenges that we've noted in reviewing enrollment as we think about what happens for the future. Again, as I guess I've been saying now for the past couple of years, we're going to continue to see this kind of slow, steady growth. You know, we'll keep pushing for that. And then I think it's fair to say at what time over the coming years you see us at that mid 11,000 range, maybe in the vicinity of 11,750 students, then we'll kind of hold off. But given the trajectory of growth, we'll continue the same program that we have for some time. And if you'd like, I'm glad to share a couple of those spots. One of the areas that we really saw a nice increase, and of course this is where you want to see good solid growth, is in our number of first-time freshmen coming to the university. If you think about Murray State being, again, a traditional residential campus, the bread and butter of that is first-time freshmen who are coming to MSU. So as we look at those numbers, we had nice growth, roughly 6.5%, and I think that just bespeaks in an amazing way the work that we've tried to do to focus on that core group of potential students who had come to the university. Largest entering class we've had, again, buttressed in large part by those first-time freshmen.
And it reduces your, your turnover rate. You know, you may show growth in graduate students, but you'll lose them in 2 years.
That's right. And one of the things that we've been really fortunate to be strong in, and we're still working to continue this as well and get better, but one of the things we continue to be strong in is retention. A critical year as you look from freshman to sophomore. Increased focus nationally on now sophomore retention. Obviously, the four-year retention rate is one we track very closely, and we've done quite well on that metric. So the fact that we're getting them here is the important component because we do have the pieces in place compared to other schools that will have us retaining them, have us keeping those students here for the 4 or 5, sometimes 6 years that it takes to get them through degree. Another area where we've been particularly strong, again, giving focus and attention to that, has been with international students overall. So if you look across the board, all the way from undergraduate to graduate, for those internationals who come here seeking a degree. We're not talking about students who may come from a country to learn the English language or have English language immersion activities, those ESL students. We're talking about those coming here for a declared degree program. We've seen amazing growth there, roughly 16% on a year-to-year comparison for all of our international students. So,
what can you attribute anything to that significant growth?
Well, I think the fact that we've been really focused in our recruitment and admissions functions with those international audiences. Again, it's not about just internationaling the campus and making us a global university, which is important for our students to come out as learned individuals having that background. But it's also a means to help absorb this capacity that we have and bring needed revenue on the tuition side to the university. So, again, it's not us just going everywhere in the world and trying to grab whomever we can. These students have to be qualified. They have to fit the Murray State University profile. But with that being the case, we've really tried to concentrate on these partner relationships in universities in a particular number of countries where we know the numbers are there, the potential is there to build enrollment, and that operation seems to be humming along quite nicely given this double-digit percentage growth on international. Now, all of that being said, we have our soft spots as well, and we have to get better in bringing transfer students to Murray State University, particularly from the community colleges. We had only about 1% generally. I've really kind of given the charge to a number of folks on campus for those numbers to get markedly better as we go into future years. We've actually made a change in directorship of our transfer center. We have a new individual, Maria Rosa, and I've already had some email going back and forth with her about how we really have to dig in and make some clear improvements here. And I think when we sit here a year from now and talk about that, you will note some marked difference. Graduate enrollment was down slightly, a little less than 1%. That's not all that surprising. When you have difficult economic times, yes, you'll see the phenomenon where at different times through a recession, students may come to the university to get some new job skills, to brush up on a mid-career certificate program. But it's not unusual overall to see graduate enrollment that can be pretty tough during times of financial or economic retrenchment. We've also made a change in terms of graduate enrollment leadership within the provost's office. So I think you'll see some movement there, although maybe not quite as much in transfer until we start to come out of the economic recession. But overall, when you think about the fact that nationally enrollment has dropped, and if you follow the popular press or the higher education press, we're going against the grain. We've had growth. Not huge, but we're getting growth when nationally that's not the case. And when you can also point to specific instances near us where the trend has been downward, probably the most obvious one that comes to mind is Southern Illinois University, Carbondale, which in their official census figures for this year showed a loss of 1,000 students. So the fact that we're about half the size of SIU Carbondale in terms of overall enrollment, and we show ourselves up, in the vicinity of 250 so students when SIUC is down 1,000, I think shows that we're on the right track, we're doing the right thing, and for the future, we're just going to kind of keep this push on for the steady, sustained growth until we hit that point where, in essence, all the theoretical slots available to us in all of our existing sections of courses are filled. We really have absorbed all of that room that we have left. And then at that point, we'll see us kind of stopping, centering in at whatever that figure may be. Again, I've mentioned 11.5, 11.750, possibly up to 12. I don't see us going larger than that. There's always the danger in getting past that point that you start to lose the feel, the culture, the engagement that makes Murray State University what it is. And we cannot have that happen. If you look at kind of a curve of enrollment growth with operational efficiency, I'm also kind of convinced personally of the fact that that peaks somewhere in that 11 to 12,000 range. And I think that becomes the place we kind of cap out.
Hear more from Dr. Dunn on Tuesday on Sounds Good with Tracy Ross and friends.
Well, the 2012 general election has come and gone, and it's brought about a change in party representation for far western Kentucky's 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th district House seats. WKMS featured candidate forums for those races because the incumbents decided to retire or otherwise not seek a second term. Without the advantages of incumbency for the traditionally Democratic seats and the state Republican Party gunning for control of the state House, our region saw its representation change from largely blue to largely red. To help add more color to the post-election landscape, Chad Lampe spoke this past Wednesday with retiring Republican 1st District State Senator Ken Winters of Murray and retiring Democratic 4th District State Representative Mike Cherry of Princeton.
So, Senator Winters, we'll start with you. The Trigg County Judge Executive Stan Humphreys will succeed you in office.
Yes.
And he was the Republican on the ticket. He received your endorsement and has since won this race. If you could tell me a bit more about your thoughts on Stan Humphreys and your thoughts on the race.
Well, I'm extremely pleased that Stan Humphreys was available and aggressively interested in pursuing this race. He's an outstanding fella. The more, I'm going to back up and say I've campaigned about as much for House representatives down here and Stan as I did for myself. So it's been a very tough year for everyone. But the more the reason I bring that up is the more I was exposed to Stan in the environment that he's running, the more and more impressed I was. It really reached a point where I made a comment that once he is before a group and they hear him and they detect that sincerity about his beliefs and where he stands and his commitments, then he virtually had them in his camp when that happened. So I'm extremely pleased about that.
Did you think that it would have been a challenge though initially because he is in a fringe county for the first district in Trigg County trying to win the rest of the counties west of him?
Well, I talked to people in more than one county about the potential there and coming down on that. He seemed to be the appropriate one, and it is unique. Probably. Me being in Callaway County made it a little easier for me, but Trigg County was a great county for me, even in both races that I had. But it really has to come down to the fact that who's the best for us, and then if they're on a fringe, if they were in Carlisle, Hickman, or Fulton counties, then name recognition becomes an issue, and we have to work harder. And we did. We worked very, very hard for Stan, but it didn't take a mountain moving event in order for him to be a key element in this race, so I'm proud of him.
And Stan Humphreys won every county in the first district except for Fulton County, and that, again, was a very close race. Representative Cherry, we'll go to you now to talk about the 4th District State House race, which is your home district you've represented since 1999. And the candidate you endorse, Raymond Janina, was not able to win last night. We had winner Lynn Beckler, who had ran against you a couple of times, right?
Just once, actually.
Just one time. So tell me a bit about where you think Mr. Janina fell short in his campaign for the State House.
Well, I want to back up just for a quick second. I know Stan Humphreys quite well, too. Of course, Trigg and Caldwell County are almost sister cities, and it's not a great surprise that Stan won that race. I am surprised of the margin of victory. That was strong, and it kind of indicated a strong Republican showing throughout the first district. But Ken, Senator Winters, mentioned a mountain-moving event, and of course the mountain-moving event was Barack Obama and his unpopularity in western Kentucky in particular, which I think was a big contributor to many races. Now, we'll never know how much of a contributor, but certainly a contributor, and certainly the Republican Party did a good job of the linkage between the Democratic candidates and Obama. I can't hardly talk about District 4 in isolation because right where you are in Callaway County and right where I am in Caldwell County, although I'm in Frankfort right now, obviously, our geographical area in Kentucky was in a very unique situation as far as the House of Representatives in Kentucky is concerned. We had four open seats, all contiguous. A block, if you will.
Yeah.
And we went into the race with three of these four seats being Democrat and one Republican. And we just totally reversed it. We came out with one Democrat and three Republicans. Interestingly enough, the change was going from Republican to Democrat, because Gerald Watkins defeated his opponent Crockett in Paducah relatively handily, and then you turn right around and have the three Republicans defeat the contiguous candidates, Kelly Whitaker getting beat by Richard Heath in District 2, Raymond Janina getting beat by Lynn Beckler in District 4, and Hal Kemp getting beat by Kenny Imes in District 5. The same thing occurred to all those candidates, and the margin of victory was very similar, 54, 55, 56% in the three respective races. Very similar geographics, very similar campaigns, and all three of the Democratic challengers lost in those three races. So it turned out to be quite interesting and quite unique, and it helped the Republicans gain the four seats, which I don't know if you want me to go into that now, but I wanted to ask you,
Representative Cherry, if you think that the outcome would have been the same if the possibility of the Republicans taking over the House was not an option.
I don't think the Republican effort to pick up the 10 seats had a big impact on our four contiguous races in the purchase, or most of the purchase, some of the Pinerol, of course. I don't think people focused on that. I think they focused on the tie-in between the state-level races and the national races, and I think the Romney coattails were just stronger and better utilized by the Republican Party than any coattails I have seen since I ran in 1998. So I don't really think that was an issue, other than you might make the case, well, there was more money donated from from various sources, and therefore that was helpful, because in the last couple of weeks there was a lot of money spent that I, for one, didn't expect to see spent, and it made a difference. But nowhere did I hear anybody talking about, oh, we got to vote Republican so they can take over the state house. I just don't think that was particularly much of a factor. Didn't need to be much of a factor as far as the individual reason that someone would vote Republican or Democrat.
We'll be back in a moment with more post-election analysis from Senator Winters and Representative Cherry. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News.
You're listening to Front Page Sunday. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. Now back to our post-election analysis from retiring 1st District State Senator Republican Ken Winters of Murray and retiring 4th District Representative Democrat Mike Cherry of Princeton. Senator Winters, let's talk about Stan Humphreys taking your seat in the state Senate. And you have served as the Education Committee Chair since your time in the state Senate. Who do you expect to succeed you, or who would you like to see succeed you in that role? And do you have any indication of whether or not Mr. Humphreys would be able to serve on the Education Committee?
Well, I think he would desire, if you talk to him, I think you would hear him say that he would like to be on the Education Committee, Agriculture, Economic Development, and Veterans Affairs. Those tend to be his interest, I've found. The decision about who the committee chair will be, naturally, at this point, is a little bit up in the air, because Senator Williams leaving, or Judge Williams, I should say, I guess today, leaving the Senate. That means that there is a leadership election to occur in the Senate, and therefore that decision will be made following that election. But, you know, there's at least two people in the Senate that I have talked to about that role. Might not be wise for me to identify them today, but there's two strong people.
But your recommendation has boded well for Stan Humphreys, so is there a reason why you would prefer not to make their names public?
No, it's just that I don't want to dictate what a new team would do, but we have Senator Wilson from over at Bowling Green. Mike Wilson would be a good one. He's been on the committee for a long time. David Givens, Senator Givens from Greene County, has been on that committee. Both of them, I've been impressed in the way they have, not coming from as in-depth of education background as I have, I've been really impressed with the degree of understanding and the study and the participation that they have on the committee. So I would be comfortable with either of those two fellows serving.
We spoke with Representative Cherry not long after he announced his retirement, and in that interview, and Representative Cherry, I'll get to you on this question in just a second, but I want to ask Senator Winters about this. Along with serving since 1999, you felt like it was time to go. You also mentioned that state government and state politics are just too partisan right now, and I wanted to ask you, Senator Winters, if you agree with that statement that you feel like Frankfort is too partisan, and also if you think that this election may change some things.
Indeed, the partisanship is a troubling element about our experience and our involvement in Frankfort, but I'm not convinced that this election is going to make a significant difference. I know that as we move forward, if there had been a 10-seat gain in the House, and by the way, Mike made a comment about there being four seats, and it looks like with some potential litigation, a thing or two, there might be one or two additional ones later, if depending on outcome of those hearings, but they did not reach that 10 level. If they had, there could have been a little less partisanship, and more bipartisan work. But it seems that we're not unique in Kentucky in that regard, though, because we're seeing it across the country, and we're seeing it at the federal level that unbelievable. I don't know whether we're duplicating them or they're duplicating us, but it is an issue, and it's an issue that impacts down-to-earth, solid decisions about our future. And you know, people ask me, do you enjoy your service? And I said, I do. When I feel that we're all trying to do something that's right rather than prevail on an issue, whether it's right or wrong. And it's not enjoyable at that point. That is not a reason that I would have left. But certainly there is a strong bipartisan atmosphere.
Representative Cherry, your thoughts?
Well, of course, I agree with most everything Senator Winter said, except I can't help from adding when Ken said if the Republicans had won 10, it would have changed things drastically in Frankfort, and indeed it would. Partisanship wouldn't even be an issue anymore because the Senate and House would both be in Republican hands. So as far as legislation is concerned, I mean, it would have made a very big difference. But on the national level, part of it is perhaps getting older, because I can remember my father and my grandfather saying much the same thing that I say. But I can't believe that it's ever been any worse than it is now as far as the partisanship at the national level and all the way down. We are becoming a blue and red nation, and I don't care for that. I hope we can all remember that we're not a blue and red. We're a United States, not blue and red states. And I still think that's an issue, and I think that the election that we just had on the national level didn't do much to change that. I hope and I seriously pray that all of us will, regardless of whether our person won or not, will remember that first and foremost we're all American citizens, and we need to strive for success in whatever we do, regardless of who's leading the country. And my four words for everybody out there would be, let's just get along. And I think that's the most important thing right now in the political scene. And we'll see how that works out. But nothing much has changed in Frankfort. The House has gone from a 59-41 to a 55-45, and that really doesn't change any of the dynamics as far as the House of Representatives is concerned, and I expect our leadership to remain the way it is. The Senate, we haven't mentioned it, but one of the shockers to me was the defeat of Joy Pendleton by a handful of votes, a little under 300 out of 37,000. So that's a handful of votes. But Joy Pendleton losing his seat over in Hopkinsville to Whitney Westerfield, that was a shocker.
Do you think that was? Sorry to interrupt you, but do you think that was again part of being down ballot from President Obama, or was there something else?
Oh, absolutely.
There?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we'll never know. But did out of 37,000 votes, was there 300 of them or so that were influenced by that? Well, of course, absolutely.
We talked to the candidates that, basically flip-flopped to far western Kentucky the seats that went from Democrat to Republican and vice versa. Obviously, the big issue has been the pension. And each one of these candidates have taken a pledge that if they can reform the pension system, they won't take a pension. But my question is, how big of an issue is lawmaker pension versus the entire state pension system? You know, if these lawmakers don't take a pension, is that going to make us solvent, Senator Winters?
Well, absolutely not.
Yeah.
No, absolutely not. That's not a big issue.
No,
about,
it won't make any difference.
No, yeah. About the 30 plus million or billion shortfall in the pension system. But you know, that's admirable for them to say that. But the retirement system, unless someone leaves it and goes somewhere else for a much higher salary and builds upon that. But the retirement for the General Assembly, which is similar to one I had at Murray State and other places where we contribute to it, and if you're only there 4 years or 8 years or 12 years, it's a very insignificant dollar value. But I am, and we have attempted to write that issue about legislative retirement in, as far as trying to do something about that, but everyone can make their own judgment about whether they want to accept it or not. But I think everyone that I've talked to on all sides say we have to do something about the general pension problems we have in Kentucky.
And Representative Cherry, yeah. You sit on the pension task force. So
well, of course, that's been my area of expertise for the last 6 or 8 years, the whole pension issue, and I've been in a meeting this morning before we've talked here in Frankfurt on it, and that's why I'm in Frankfurt instead of down at the studio with you guys. It's interesting, Ken, you know, Albert Robertson, who was the author of the bill that changed the pension system, it came from the Senate to the House, and we've all tried various ways to change it in the last few years, and I'll get to that just for a minute. But Albert Robertson got reelected to the Senate, and so it didn't seem to have a whole lot of impact, at least on his race. But the biggest cost factor of the legislative pension retirement system is this thing called reciprocity, where in 2004 legislation was passed, which I voted against, by the way, for whatever that's worth, and it just barely passed in the House, but it did pass, and it set up a reciprocity situation where Ken or I could go to work for the governor or the government in some way, in state government, and work for 3 years, and then we would get our high three, and whatever our salary was for those 3 years, we'd be able to credit all of our time in the legislature against it, and of course end up getting a very much higher salary. But we are looking at a roughly $35 billion shortfall in the Kentucky retirement systems across the board. Of that, the legislative part of that is almost non-existent. I mean, we're talking a few million dollars. Now, that's big bucks, but in the context of $35 billion, it's meaningless. But, boy, it is a good campaign issue, and it is an issue that ought to be fixed. And when I say legislators, all you folks out there, I'm also included judges. Nobody talks about it very much, but it's both the judicial and the legislative system. Retirement system that needs to be changed, and I'm quite confident we will take care of that. Mm-hmm. It tickles me over the years, you know, for one person to run and say, I'm going to come up to Frankfurt, I'm going to fix everything. Well, good luck with that. I mean, nothing's more discouraging to see somebody running up here and they got the answers. Oh, well, I never thought about that. For goodness sakes, thank you for instructing me. I shouldn't go there. I'm through for a minute.
Well, no, but did Representative Fred Nessler, did he opt into that situation where he's taken a job with the Agriculture Department?
Well, Freddie hasn't retired yet.
Yeah. So if he works, if he spends 3 years with the Agriculture Department, would that be his high three? Is that how that works?
That's the way it would work. Yeah.
Okay.
But there is a flip flop on that also, and I suspect, you know, I wasn't in for 2004, but I suspect there are people that voted for this because of the opposite application of it too. Let's say someone was a teacher for 25 years or 24 years, and they decided to run for the Senate. Well, I can't run for the Senate because I'm locked in. I'm a captive in a retirement system, so I can't do that. But the reciprocity part of it would have, even though we don't hear about those, the reciprocity would have allowed a person with 24 years in the teaching profession to then run for office and use those 4 years or 2 years. It'd have to be five to be, well, it wouldn't have to be for them to use it for their retirement, but they could apply that to their retirement. Their best 5 years or best 3 years would have been in their previous employment, not in the new one. So it would work both ways, but the one that Mike mentions, and then we all agree, this is just not the way that anyone thought this bill would work.
No, it wasn't thought through well enough, and it was one of those bills that went through at the last minute. Wasn't time to spend a lot of time looking for it, because I was on state government committee. I knew and was, well, that's past history. But you talked about Freddie Nestler. An even more current example is our friend David Williams,
who has gone
to $100,000+ judgeship, and he more so than Fred Nestler will be in a position where he could receive a much larger retirement issue. But I think the bottom line on the whole retirement issue is the only way to get rid of this is to put the legislators and judicial folks under the same system as everybody else. And that's where I'm the co-chair, along with Damon Thayer, who's the Republican senator who chairs the equivalent committee over in the Senate. Both of us certainly agree that we need to change that, and I think the political will to do that now exists.
My last question for both of you is something that many Kentucky voters might have been surprised to see, the ballot measure to solidifying the hunting as a constitutional right. What prompted this, and was it necessary? Is there a threat to hunting rights in Kentucky?
No, there's not a threat, and it was just, in my opinion, I supported it. Of course, it started over here in the House in 2011, and we passed it unanimously. Well, duh. I don't know what the final figures were, but somewhere around 80%, I'm sure. And it's one of those no-brainers, feel-good legislation, but in my opinion, absolutely not necessary. Now, you can throw up, depending if you're a conspiracy theorist or whatever, you could probably throw up some scenario where it would make a difference, but I would think any scenario that it would in the future make a difference is a very unrealistic scenario. And if we've gotten to the point where our hunting and fishing constitutional rights are being threatened, I dare say we'll have a lot more serious problems than whether we can go hunting or not.
Well, I think the basic premise of this was that should something happen about firearms control that eliminated the ability to have a firearm, then if we had a constitutional document that says we indeed are moving forward with the option to hunt and fish and so forth, then we have to have weapons to do that. I don't think there's a threat either, but I suspect, I don't know the author of the bill, but I suspect the real intent was, let's protect ourselves down the road should something come up that tries to put pressure on our ability to have firearms and use them for recreation and hunting type of activity. So, yeah, it is a feel-good kind of vote, and I think you saw across the state that it wasn't just the General Assembly that felt good about it.
Well, we've been joined this half hour by Republican Senator Ken Winters, the 1st District State Senator, who's retiring after 8 years of service and chairing the Education Committee in the State Senate, and Representative Mike Cherry, 4th District State Representative, who served now in his 14th year, and he's been the chair of the State Government Committee in Frankfort. He's on the line from Frankfort, and Representative Cherry, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. As always, enjoyed it and hope to do it again sometime.
And Senator Winters, thank you very much for coming in, and we appreciate your time and insight.
Well, we appreciate your opportunities always to come and be with you, and we enjoy listening to your coverage. As I'm traveling back and forth last night from community to community, I was attuned to your analysis of the race, so I appreciate being here.
Thank you. This conversation originally aired Wednesday on Sounds Good, our new midday music and conversation program that airs weekdays from 11 to 1. Hear this conversation again at WKMS.org.
sun shines bright on my old Kentucky home. 'Tis summer, the people are gay.
When we come back, Kate Lochte looks back at the November 3rd performance of the Paducah Symphony Orchestra with PSO conductor and artistic director Raffaella Ponti. Then we'll hear a conversation about the latest Market House Theater production, one that speaks to both the little kid and the chocolate lover in all of us. Golden ticket not required. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News.
This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. This weekend and next, Paducah's Market House Theater indulges your sweet tooth with their production of Willy Wonka Jr. The show follows Charlie Bucket's quest for a golden ticket and his tour of Willy Wonka's fabled chocolate factory. If you're familiar with the 1971 Gene Wilder film, this promises to be a trip down memory lane. For those who aren't, it promises to be a sweet experience. Kate Lochte speaks with the show's director, April Cochran.
I'm glad you're with us and hope that maybe you'll open by talking about how many schools are involved, school children are involved. It looks like a great cross-pollination of kids.
It really is. We have a stellar cast of 40 that are going to be on our stage, and they come from all over our region, not just McCracken County, but like North Marshall. We've got some kids from Southern Illinois, really from all over, from ages 7 through 18.
Not only public school kids, but homeschooled kids are involved. It must be wonderful watching them get to know each other.
It really is. We had well over 100 kids audition for the show, so you know we've really got the cream of the crop in this production.
Well, tell us about your co-conspirators in getting this production on stage, and you might want to remind us of actually what the story is of Willy Wonka.
Well, I tell you what, I have rarely been so excited about a production as I am about this one, because we have absolutely crammed it with special effects. We're going to be using the flying in the fizzy lifting drink room. We've got trap doors with lifts for the nut room. We're going to use our first use of our motorized turntable in years. It's a multimedia show with videos and stills, and it's just, we're making the whole theater experience an immersive one. When you walk in the theater lobby, you're entering a magical candy land. We have decorated the lobby to look like a huge candy place. It's just candy all over the place, oversized, bright, magical candy. You walk into the theater just before it starts the show. You hear Wonka's factory working. You see jets of steam shoot out. And then the curtain opens, and you are transported to this wonderful, magical land. I am just so excited. Michael Cochran has put together just an amazing multimedia set to take all of these different locations, of starting from the city of where we meet Charlie Bucket and his family, very poor. But Willy Wonka has decided to hide 5 golden tickets in candy bars, and whichever 5 children find those tickets are able to have a lifetime supply of chocolate and take a free tour of the factory. And then the factory is brought to life with all of these amazing special effects. I'm just so incredibly excited to have people come see it.
You've got a full 2-weekend run, and you're also doing school shows. Tell us about that.
Well, we do have performances for 2 full weekends. We're doing Thursday through Sunday. It opens this Thursday. Performances are Thursday and Friday at 7:30, and then Saturdays and Sundays at 2:30. In addition, we do 6 school matinee performances for local elementary and middle schools and homeschool groups from around our region. So that's really fun, too. Those are conducted during the day, in the mornings. And, in fact, the cast basically ends up with 3 show days. They'll do 2 school performances back-to-back and then come back to the theater that night for an evening show. So they get quite a workout.
Remind us as well of the songs, because they're all pretty feel-good songs.
They really are. Of course, there's I've Got a Golden Ticket, which is just filled with joy. And there's the Oompa Loompa songs, and there's four of those, just amazingly fun. And then Cheer Up Charlie, which is actually more of a kind of a ballad, and that is from the original Wonka movie. And then there are songs that you don't know, that you've probably never heard, that were written specifically for the stage adaptation of the movie version, the original movie version of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. There are songs like I See It All on TV and I Eat More, and fun songs like that. So it's really, really great. And our music director, Cindy Miller, has done an amazing job of working with all these young performers to get them to do their absolute best. And, of course, we can't forget the wonderful Veruca Salt song, I Want It Now. That's in the show as well.
What do you hear the kids talking about when you're at rehearsals?
They are absolutely floored by the special effects as well. Every time we'd bring one out, or we'd say, oh, guys, we're going to have Wonka appear up out of the floor. They're like, what? No, really? And yeah, we are. And then when we did it in tech, we just had tech on Sunday, and they're like, wow, oh, this is amazing. And, of course, we have lots of videos that go in the background, and we just received a grant from the Kentucky Colonels to get a new digital projector, which has just a tremendous amount more brightness and power than our previous projector did. So now you can stand right in front of the screen and there are no shadows cast on it, and it's just bright, you know, just really, really wonderful clarity. So when it's supposed to snow in the scene where Charlie finds the money to be able to buy the candy bar that has the golden ticket in it, there is a snowstorm going on behind him on the screen. And it's just been so much fun how everything has come together in a magical way to make this amazing show come alive. And we cannot wait for audience members to come and just walk in the theater doors and be transported for an hour and 15 minutes or so of just taking them away from their everyday lives and just being transported to magic.
Do these students come up through your Young Actors theater groups?
Many of them do. I would say at least half of the kids have come up through our Footlights program and have been involved with us for quite some time. And then, which is equally as wonderful, is we have kids that we had never seen before, brand new kids at audition. We usually do have 100 or so kids audition for our shows each time. And we always have new kids involved as well. So it's a good mix of brand new talent and kids that we have worked with over the years.
Willy Wonka Jr. runs this weekend and next at Market House Theater in Paducah. You can find more information about getting your golden ticket at WKMS.org.
Hold your breath. Make a wish. Count to three.
Come with me and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look and you'll see into your imagination. We'll begin with a spin, traveling in the world of my creation. What we'll see will defy explanation. Want to view paradise, simply look around and view it. Anything you want to do it, want to change the world, there's nothing to it.
At 11 o'clock this morning, we preempt the first hour of A Prairie Home Companion to broadcast a concert featuring Rossini's overture to Semiramide and Elgar's Enigma Variations performed by the Paducah Symphony Orchestra in the Carson Center on November 3rd. We regret to report that violinist Pip Clark, the guest soloist with the symphony for Brooks Scottish Fantasy, would not permit the broadcast for her performance. Kate Lochte spoke with symphony artistic director and conductor Raffaele Ponti after the show.
Tell me about the music I heard.
Well, this Rossini is that typical Rossini overture of excitement. That's why they call him Signor Crescendo. From that first moment, he just gets louder and builds and louder and louder. So that by the time we're finished with this lovely appetizer, the audience's hearts are racing, ready to go into the concerto. And Signor Amede is one of those pieces, unfortunately, that opera doesn't get performed in the United States any longer. Once in a while, you still see it in Italy, but very seldom. But the overture itself stands alone as a fabulous concert overture. After intermission, it's Sir Edward Elgar's Enigma Variations for orchestra. And this is a great piece of music. I find it to be charming, witty, fun, serious, exciting. It has all the emotions in it and all of the variations. So people are always asking me all week long, so Maestro, what is the enigma? What is this about? And they think that it's about each variation. And I have to explain to them, no, it's not. That's not the enigma. Because we know through either the initials or the names of these people of whom he was writing about. These were his friends, his colleagues, one was even his wife. So we know who they were, the people. He was trying to capture their personalities, their persona, the ideas, and who they were to him. And he did a wonderful job because they're all very different in the variations. So what is the enigma? Well, the enigma is that there is no main theme. Just a great performance. You're going to love it. The PSO is sounding great this week. I'm very excited about this opportunity.
So, Maestro, there was a reception after the performance. What did you hear from the audience?
Well, the buzz was wonderful in the concert hall, even during the intermission. But there was so much going on because what the PSO is doing nowadays is creating not just concerts, but concert events. And this was centered around the Piers for Paducah, the release of our new book that was put out to benefit the Paducah Symphony Orchestra. And what this does, it was all done with local artists, and a book was put together from A to Z, and it was voted upon about what letter would receive which information. It's just wonderful because what it's doing is helping us bring the community together. Music is, of course, the end-all for us, the symphony orchestra. But it's about, for me, as you know, we've talked many times about this, engaging the community, enriching lives through great music. It's what you do. It's what I do. It's just really wonderful. The buzz was amazing at the concert hall. We're very excited.
I understand on Facebook that the young artist who painted the cow on the second balcony, her picture took $1,600 in the silent auction.
Isn't that amazing? That's just really wonderful. And the fact that the artists were there live represented was just a great, great possibility. People are getting their books signed by the artists. I mean, it's just a wonderful event. The actual artwork was there live. We have jazz playing in the lobby. There was two separate parties for patrons. We had people sitting on the stage with the orchestra, if you noticed. And these were people who supported the concert. These were the people that were the backers. They were actually sitting on the stage. I really think that the moment you walk into the Symphony Hall on Saturday evenings with the Paducah Symphony Orchestra, the performance begins the moment you park your vehicle. There's such synergy going on. It's the best party in town. It's the who's who in that lobby. It's just very exciting.
Kate Lochte spoke with Paducah Symphony Orchestra artistic director and conductor Raffaele Ponti. And listen, this morning at 11, we'll preempt the first hour of A Prairie Home Companion for the November 3rd PSO concert. You've been listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. Our correspondents are Drew Adams, Shelley Baskin, Angela Hatton, Whitney Jones, Casey Northcutt, and Dave Chenault. Kate Lochte and Tracy Ross are contributing producers, and Matt Markgraf provides website assistance.
We welcome your questions or comments about the stories you've heard today. You can email them to msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu, post them to our Facebook page, or tweet them to @WKMS. You can find links to all three at wkms.org, where you can also hear any of today's features again. Thanks for listening.